Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, September 26, 2019. And if you haven't noticed already, there's a bit of a frog in my throat. But I'll tell you that I had some kind of a cold monster take over my body this last week. So if I seem to have fallen off the map, there's a reason for that. And interestingly enough, I got the cold by visiting a health institution. That's all I'm going to say about that. But yeah, I'll tell you, I was a one hurting dude. But better now, doing all the vitamin C, taking all the right stuff, and getting better. Still got a little nasal congestion, but back up to my game again. Okay, so tonight's show, a whole host of topics centered around water and energy and airlines and the wing generator and all kinds of topics. So listen up. This is kind of funny. I get a newsletter because I'm a member of scientific organizations. One comes in from, it's called the SPA. It's the group. It's one of the study groups under the American Geophysical Union. That is the SPA is for solar and related solar system studies. But anyway, that something caught my eye, and one of the things was that you, as a non-major NASA scientist, could put in a proposal for some kind of a future payload on a space exploration satellite, okay? So, and I read, and they said they encourage subjects and topics that have been marginalized. So, that it caught my eye even more. And I thought, oh, gee, well, doggone, that might be me, been marginalized by NASA. And so then I read the fine print once I got to the application page, and doggone, I guess I don't qualify because it's only for NASA internal employees. So you have to be in a specific group related to research, of which there are probably maybe tens of thousands of employees like that in NASA who work on projects and do maybe minor contributions. And then there's only, you know, after the money gets up to the top of the pyramid, there's only a few things that actually get funded. And then the PIs, the principal investigators, the guys I used to rub shoulders with when I was at Cornell, and their ilk, I should say, get the notoriety for all of this. And I always used to say, you know, when you look at this, it's the engineers that build these amazing spacecraft, and they never get any notoriety at all. They're back in the back room designing and building all this stuff and making it work, and you know, the telecommunications and the telemetry and the all of the, you know, robotics, whatever goes with it. And then the PI sits back, smokes his cigar, and interprets the data. And that's what you see. You know, if you read Science or, you know, Nature magazine, those are the Nature is the English version of Science. Science is the so-called golden holy grail of science information, and NASA has a rubber stamp permit to print anything they want there. Same with Nature in England. But this program, which they were encouraging people who had been marginalized, only if you're a national NASA employee working in central core science groups and you were marginalized, could you possibly get your application in through this process. So anyway, just kind of a still NASA is for insiders only. I probably mentioned this before. This was back in the pre-Hubble Space Telescope days. And NASA put out an offering. It was for amateur astronomers to apply for use on the Hubble Space Telescope. And there were seven different categories that you could apply in. And so I applied in all seven categories. And I created, this was for astrophysics, this was for planetary science, for various things. It's a long time ago, but this was after my time at Cornell University, but very fresh in the minds of all the people who encountered me, let's put it that way, during those years. And, of course, I continued with my work, going to meetings, of course, paying my own way, etc. So everybody was very well versed in who I was. So anyway, I applied to these, and each group had a referee group that refereed the proposals that would come into the finals, and then a single group would put them all together and figure out who the winners would be in the various categories. So I thought, okay, I'm going to apply in all seven categories. And so I did. And I made this first cut screening, and I was in five of the categories through the first screening. And so after the second screening, I made it into the finals in five categories. And so now all of my proposals in the five categories were going to go to the central final referee group for them to decide. And I can only imagine the look on the faces. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that room when my proposals, my finalist proposals, came up in all five groups with my name on it. And I guarantee you the people in that final referee group were people that knew me probably personally and really didn't like me probably. But as you might imagine, I did not get any of my proposals verified in the very end. Okay, well, enough of that stuff. But the NASA is a closed-loop organization, and that's the way it is. Here's something very interesting dealing with water. Now, studies are going on all the time regarding city water, and this was initiated by the fiasco in Flint, Michigan, when they said it was lead in the water. But how ridiculous, because the city of Flint switched their water supply from underground wells to the river, the Flint River, and which people said was notorious for showing burning flames on the surface of the river. That's how polluted it was. And so lead was not the only pollutant. It was just full of every chemical you could imagine being dumped by industry. Okay, so at any rate, this started a whole movement of study, independent groups, environmental protection groups, environmental community groups and working groups, etc. And so more and more data has accumulated on city water systems and their pollution. Now, I've been through this myself. I went to the city government where I lived once, and I said I wanted to see the water testing, and they got very offended. They got very offended because I was asking them basically to show me the results of their testing. And what I found out was they were fudging the testing because they were somewhat consistent from month to month. So they just write some numbers in, file it, and do their federal reporting. But what I realized was the federal standards for water are horrifically low. They're very, very poor water standards. And so they don't cover all the myriad of chemicals and carcinogenics and organic chemicals, and not the least of which, say, pharmaceuticals, which the water is loaded with. And so there's this whole list, heavy metals. Arsenic is something that is controlled by federal standards, but very poorly controlled. And so cities can get bypasses, etc., on their arsenic levels, arsenic also being a carcinogen. Okay, so anyway, this data is becoming more readily available. And so what I'm offering to people is if you send me your zip code, I can do a search on the various studies that have been done and reply to you what's in your water. And if you go to, say, your local municipal government, they're going to tell you that your water meets federal standards, and they're going to tell you with a straight face like they're really on top of this. But the reality is, if you look at your water in any community, you're going to find that there are probably between 5 to 10 to 20 to 30 in some communities, and some much higher number of pollutants, which are carcinogens, known carcinogens, in your water. And the government guidelines do not even test for those. So if you send me your zip code, and use the address at the top of my webpage, jmccsci.com, there's an email address that I'll put there. It's the jmcc@jmckennyscience.com. Not too hard to remember, but somewhat difficult to spell. What I'll do is look up for the test results of your community, then I'll send it back to you, and then also recommend a water filter that might be right for you. But the thing about my water filters is, first of all, they take out more carcinogens and chemicals and heavy metals than any other system on the market. Most systems out there, especially from the large companies, when they're mass producing in large numbers, they can't do the quality that I can produce on my level. And so they're usually basically using carbon, which takes out one or two things, like chlorine. Just pure carbon is good at that, but pure carbon does not take out arsenic, does not take out chloramines, I'm not going to list everything, but just pure carbon, charcoal as it's called, does not take out very much at all. But most of the, like I say, the big manufacturers, that's all they have in their filter. Okay, so go to my webpage, and it's the same email address that I have on the top of the webpage for the JMCC wing, if you want to notice that. Once again, it's jmcc@jmckennyscience.com. And just include your zip code, say you want a water check, and I'll get back to you with what's really in your water, and you'll probably be really, really surprised. So the other thing is, a number of weeks ago, I announced that this past summer had been rather slow for water filter orders. And it's the way it is. You know, sometimes things are good, sometimes they're not so good. But it was starting to get to the point where, in the end of the summer was coming. So I made an announcement, and I said, please, if you need water filters, consider buying them from me. I have the best prices. I have the best water filters. Free shipping, even though shipping is outrageous. I won't go into that again. But so people have responded. So thank you very much, first of all. And then also, please keep it up, because this is an ongoing situation with me where, I have free airtime. I pay for the airtime myself, I should say. It's not free. And I pay for all of my webpage, everything that goes on, and just the basics. And that comes out of the profits from my water filter sales. And I'm not Amazon. I don't want to post on Amazon. I was almost to the point where, doggone, all my competitors are on Amazon. I don't want to go there. I want to stay independent. I want to sell my water filter products on my page, and I want my fan base to support me. So that's all I'll say. Just go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and do that. Send in your zip code, and I'll get back to you with what chemicals are in your water that your city's not going to tell you about. And this is results from chemical studies that have been done by independent groups. Okay. The airline known as Thomas Cook has gone under, and many other, especially European, small local airlines are on the brink of bankruptcy. Now, apparently this is due to many factors, one including the strong U.S. dollar. So it's the U.S. dollar is affecting foreign economies because of its strength. Now, I don't follow all of the money markets around the world, but I do follow some of them. And I've noticed that for sure, the United States dollar is very strong. Yeah. So anyway, that's interesting. But last week I talked about the collapse of the U.S. power generation companies. I talked with an analyst who is an attorney for large companies, talked to this past week, and I was amazed that he was not aware of the financial collapse of, for example, PG&E and the pending collapse of big companies like Xcel Energy Company in the Midwest because of the burden of nuclear power plants. Now, the nuclear industry is one of the most protected industries on the planet, and it's one of the most volatile. We never developed in the United States a good nuclear program. And nuclear of itself is really a bad technology because you're left with the waste, and it's a tremendously polluting waste. It's not like coal or natural gas, the other two main sources of electrical energy. Nuclear is a horrific polluter. And anyway, it's a long story. I'm not going to go into that. But the pending collapse of U.S. power companies, it's within the next 2 years, I predict that probably 90% of U.S. electric power generation companies will be in bankruptcy court for reorganizations, and then you're going to see the rates skyrocket, and you will be trapped. You won't have any place to go. You're going to have to pay that 20 to 30 cents a kilowatt hour. It's happening in California, and the consumer is losing on all of this. I talked to a person familiar with the California housing market. They were saying that the amount of money that you have to pay for inspection of a house now has gone up by 80%. So just to get the inspection and all of that legalese done to build a house, the costs have gone up enormously. Okay, so I'll be talking more about wind energy, etc., in a minute. But here's an interesting twist. On the wing generator, something that I've predicted is coming down the line also, and that is that the cruise ships, of all things, are starting to get resistance. A number of weeks ago, I talked about this on the show, that this was relative to dumping gray water, which the cruise ships typically today have a processing plant for the human waste part of the wastewater on a cruise ship. And then they have stations where they're supposed to offload that onshore, and then it goes off to a regular processing plant, like one giant flush when they come and anchor at port. But the gray water still gets dumped out in the ocean, and so you'll see these. I came up out of one of the Virgin Islands one time in a small plane, and came around the island and looked down on the back side of the island. The cruise ships normally go to the other side of the island to pick up and dump off passengers, but they went around to this cove on the back side of the island, and both these babies were unloading that waste out into the Caribbean, that beautiful Caribbean water. And just out of the back side of each one of those cruise ships was a big brown streak that just filled the ocean. I can't even imagine what that does to the fish or the wildlife in the water, the ducks and the birds, whatever else deals with that water. But here's an interesting twist on this, that the Cannes, France, is now prohibiting, this is one of the biggest cruise ports in France, is now prohibiting cruise ships for the use of sulfur-rich diesel fuel. Now, most of the cruise ships burn a sulfur-rich diesel fuel, which is very polluting, that has 2,000 times more sulfur than regular diesel that you would see being burned in a truck on the highway. 2,000 times more sulfur, and, of course, a lot of other pollutants. And this is the dirty this is extracted. Now, I've talked about dirty coal and clean coal before so that you understand this. And that's another thing that regular science cannot answer, why some coal deposits are dirty, full of chemicals, and other coal deposits are clean. And that's because during the tsunamis that are natural tsunamis, like in Pennsylvania, where the Canary Islands would send over a tsunami every now and then because of underground or underwater landslides, send those tsunamis across, and then the West Virginia, they would go in as far as West Virginia or into the hills of Pennsylvania and dump all that plant matter that had scooped up off the shoreline, dump it there, and then those are clean coal. So when Trump talks about burning clean coal, that's what he's talking about. There was no cometary input influx of hydrocarbons and sulfur dioxide and all of the other chemicals that come in from outer space with a comet. When the comet, large comet, comes by and it causes a tidal wave, that creates also a coal bed from all of the plant material that's scooped up and dumped down. Coal beds could not possibly be from plant life, from plant life that just fell down, because plant life within a week, not even a month, a week, decays, breaks down to the point where it's unrecognizable. Certainly, okay, max 1 month, and especially in a tropical climate. There, most of the fern forests were in tropical climate, so that material breaks down very readily. So if you look at coal, it's not a solid mass of like small material. It's basically fossilized plant material that's just piled up and piled up and piled up. So you can take coal and basically split it in layers, and on every layer there's a fossil of a plant. So that material came and was dumped like right now. Very huge deposits of it, and that's because the tsunami comes in, dumps it into caverns, into hillsides, into ravines, etc. And that's where the coal fields come from. Okay, so the dirty coal, the high sulfur content coal, etc., came from tsunamis that were induced by large comets passing by Earth. So it would induce the tsunami that would drag the material in. But along with that comes the pollution that the ancients talk about during the Venus event, where the pollution came in, the hydrocarbons and naphtha and every other chemical under the sun, literally. And so that's where this high polluting oil comes from, where they're extracting it from the ground. So the high sulfur diesel that the cruise ships are burning, they can get away with it because they're out in international waters. So Cannes, France, is prohibiting them from coming in and dumping their waste and using high sulfur content diesel. This brings up a plan that I have for the JMCC wing generator. And now, this might bring back the term sail away, because the wing generator, of course, is based on principles that I've understood because of my background in designing boats and studying boat design and studying the creation of large sailing vessels from small ones and the design parameters, how they grow and the limitations, etc. So the wing generator is based on an understanding of aerodynamics of sails, basically, as many sails on this and other factors. The patent, in fact, has many of these factors built into the patent itself. Too many to enumerate on this program. But anyway, imagine that on a ocean-going cruise ship now, you have, instead of smokestacks, you have wing generators along the top deck. And that energy is translated into electric motors which power the boat. And that is the future. So if you can imagine that, start to get used to it. I have drawings of this in my own notes, etc. But there's no reason for burning on a place that always has wind, the ocean, why would a cruise ship then use diesel fuel? And of course, you might have diesel fuel or some other form of fuel for those moving into shore or close maneuvers, etc. But on an open stretch of ocean, for the majority of the energy used by that ship, you would be using the wing generators. Okay, so just back a note when I was talking about the water situation in the cities. Just try this. If you go to your local city, municipality, ask them if they are current on their water standards and water testing. I'll just go through a little rendition of what I went through also in my own experimentation and trying to get water tested for my own house. But the city is going to tell you that your water meets federal standards. And there, if you show them the studies that have been done that I'm going to send to you, they're going to be very offended, but they'll still repeat that your water meets federal standards. In other words, all they have to do is meet those standards, nothing else, nothing to see here, move along. Okay, I took to task my city and insisted that I see the records. And so it turns out that they were fudging the tests. They weren't doing the tests. They were just filling them out and registering them. But then I said, okay, I want to find a water filter, a water testing company that will test my water. So that shouldn't be too hard in the United States. A water testing company or a company, a laboratory to test water, tell you what's in your water, that shouldn't be too hard to do. So this is back in probably 15 years ago, maybe more. And so I started looking around for water testing companies. And I found a few that, you know, we test water, you know, excellent, all of their credentials, etc. So I called up one and I said, I want to test my city water. And they got really, really defensive. They're like, whoa. And I was like, why do you want to do that? Well, I want to see what's in my water. So they said, okay, well, you can, if you pay for it, we'll test your water. So they said, okay, they'll send me the kit. So I get this page, and it, there's a columns, and I'm supposed to check off the things that I want tested for in my water. And there's a fee for each one. It's like expensive. I mean, it's like, you know, a lot of money per item. And so then I was supposed to go down and check which ones I wanted to be tested for. And I called them back up and I said, well, can't you just run an infrared scan on this and tell me what's in my water? And they said, well, what do you want to know about what's in your water? And I said, well, everything that's not H2O. H2O is water. I want to know everything else that's not H2O. And I had a round with them because they were just like, they couldn't imagine somebody asking what's in my water. So finally, that didn't work because it would have cost me a fortune. And so anyway, that's the level of testing capability that was around 15 years ago. Now people are taking it a bit more seriously because there must be some money in it. There must be some grant money available that allows these companies to go out and test city water. So anyway, once again, just look on my webpage, send me your zip code, and I'll look up in the databases of pollution and see what's in your area and then reply to you. Okay, on to more information about developing what are known as cooperative energy systems. And this is something that is a natural progression of what I'm doing with the wing generator. I've announced that people with interests in small wing generators, the 2, the 3, and the 5 kilowatts and the 10 kilowatts, I'm now bringing those online as products. Because before, I was just interested in selling the bigger ones, like the 50 kilowatts and above. But what I'm realizing, there's a demand for the smaller ones, and it's a very healthy demand. although there's not as much profit in that. So what I've tried to do is reduce the complexity of the systems, which of course would reduce the cost of the systems. But the next stage is very interesting, and that is local cooperative electrical systems. And now this is something that, once again, I'll just tell you that there's no viable system for a local cooperative. And I'll tell you what actually is happening in when people talk about co-ops. I know people that have purchased into what are known as co-ops. For example, one is a guy who has a farm, and he put up some solar panels. And he went around the neighborhood and he said, if you buy my electricity that I produce on my solar panels, it'll cost you a little bit more, but you'll be green and getting your electricity from my solar panels. And the neighbors bought into it and paid. And so he could plug into the grid and provide electricity, but of course he only provides electricity for a few hours a day. And so that's considered a cooperative. It's not a solution. It's certainly nothing that's going to compete against the local power company. So they welcome it so they can be green, but not have any real competition. Okay, so that's the kind of co-op you may have heard about. The kind of co-op I'm talking about is where a community would go completely off the grid. So the energy would be produced locally and by the wing generator, and then distributed, and then the equipment set up so that you would have your power source at your house with controlled voltage. And so that is what I see the future of co-ops, a totally independent scenario where the people would get their electricity. And the advantage, of course, is that as electric prices go up, and they are going to, as I just mentioned, all of these electric companies are going to be in bankruptcy court within 2 years. The people out on the fringes in communities, in remote communities, are going to be paying very high electric costs. So it's going to be essential for them to find real solutions. And three-blade wind turbines and solar panels are a determinably false solution. They don't work. They don't provide energy. And they're very expensive for the energy that is derived for them. They're not a solution. So they're loved by the local power company because the local power company doesn't have any real competition. So this is the beginning of building up a nationwide grid being powered by the wing generator. But this is something that if you're in a situation like this, if you're in a community, if you're in and I'm actually working with some groups right now, it's a very a system where there are communities that want to get off the grid. One community, their electric bill was about $7,000 per month. And they use a lot of electricity. They do farming. They have people that are living there. They have a lot of electric expense. And so probably one of the biggest line items in their financial statement is electricity. So they're a perfect candidate to get energy from a wing generator that is serious energy, not pretend energy, and get very close to off the grid. Now, so once we get experience with this level of system, then it will grow, because I estimate that with 1,000 of the large wing generators, we can power the entire country. And I just had a little spat, kind of a round of chatter, and I typically don't go on blogs, but this time I did. And somebody comes back with the standard wind argument. Well, what are you going to do when the wind ain't blowing? Well, the issue is on a national level, and I've done studies, on a national level, there's always wind blowing someplace. And so if you overbuild with wing generators, something that you could never possibly do either with solar or three-blade wind turbines, if you overbuild, then in the areas that are deficient on wind, you can move the electricity around because That's the way the Tesla grid was designed with Nikola Tesla. The idea was that if electricity was needed, you could move it through the grid elements to various locations and provide power where there was none. Say if a generator goes out in a certain area, you can move power into that area automatically in the grid. It just flows with series of diodes and transformers through the grid elements. So the original grid was set up to self-regulate itself. And I've also mentioned that the supposed smart grid, thank goodness that thing never went anyplace, that was always a big boondoggle. That was they were trying to sell it as something to prevent EMP attacks. And as I've said before, by the time your smart grid figures out that there's been an EMP attack, the EMP impulse wave is moving at the speed of light, your signal to warn other stations cannot catch up to it. So there's no way a smart grid is going to do anything to combat against EMPs. The best way to combat against EMPs is to put in hardening systems at the local level, and that's literally what Tesla did. There are shunts, there are other mechanisms to bring grid elements out of service when they are overburdened. But anyway, that's another story. So the grid is already set up to do this and then have people control their voltages at the local levels. So at any rate, the beginning of this is with the local co-ops. Now, the reason I'm talking about this is because I know there are more and more groups out there that fit into the local co-op scenario. So I'm going to invite you to respond to email me and use that email address at the top of my webpage, the jmcc@jmcanniescience.com. It's at the top of my webpage where I talk about input regarding the wing generator. Write to me and say you have a situation where you think a cooperative, an electric cooperative, would fit. And then we'll do an analysis and start talking, start the conversation, and see if it's a fit, look for wind in your area, etc. And so that's the next level. So, you know, starting out with the way this kind of rolled out, starting out with the 50-kilowatt wing generator, that's what I used during the XPRIZE competition, using it to win the 2018 Technology Innovation Achievement Award from the XPRIZE, and then my realization that when people started writing in asking for the wing generator, a lot of them didn't fit into that power category. They were much smaller. So that opened up the field for the small 2, 3, 5, and 10 kilowatt systems. And then but then the cooperatives might be using the 100 to 250 kilowatt systems. And so this is what I call the small wing generator. And that's what we want to advance right now. So, for example, a 250 kilowatt wing generator would be enough to supply a small cooperative and provide very handily the amount of energy that would be used. And so the way we're going about this, there's some groups that are starting by installing a smaller one just to get a handle on what it's going to do, and then with results of that going up to the bigger ones. So anyway, there's a number of different ways to proceed. Anyway, just rolling that idea out as the next phase, that local cooperatives, and it might be 10 houses, it might be 3 houses, might be 5 houses, could be 10, could be 50, it could be 200 houses in a small like development that wants to go independent. And so we have to see what kind of electric usage is occurring so that we could design a system and then install it. So at any rate, the benefit about the cooperatives is there are many ways that we can find help in the communities to get these things rolling. So at any rate, once again, just use that address, email, if you believe you have a situation where you could install an electric co-op with the wing generator, and also have, for example, EV charging stations as part of it. That would be one good application if you have water pumping needs or water filtration needs, any water needs that would go along with it, including that in the proposal. So a lot of options there. If you have water sources, if you don't have water sources, we could figure that out, how to get water into the area, or if there's already water there, how to pump it, store it, and create reservoirs, etc., so that you're also water independent. Now, one of the next questions that people have is, what about batteries? And here's an interesting issue with the wing generator also, and that is that I'm trying to reduce the amount of batteries that people need. And this is something that a balanced system. Now, typically, if you put in solar panels, say you put in a solar panel system, you would have to pay an enormous price for batteries and then have to build your solar panel system up to 6 or 7 times the amount of energy you need at a single moment to store up the energy you need for all that time when the solar panels are not working. Okay, so solar doesn't work to go independent. The only way solar works is to be on grid and supply a little bit of energy to the power company, and they give you a credit. Okay, but so the only real source of energy for an independent cooperative type of system is the wind, because it blows 24/7. And we've been doing some studies around the country on wind, and it's amazing the number of places. Every state has a windy area that it just blows like crazy. And some people live in these areas, and it's just like, you know, you can't get out of your car. The doors are going to go flying off your car if you get out of the car. And this is many, many places around the country. So there's plenty of wind, and if you're in these wind zones, I mean, you're really set. You're going to have all the energy you need and more. But if you're in an area that does not have much wind, then there's potentially other solutions also. There are places where there's not much wind at all, and they'll go for months with very little wind at all. So those are not good locations for localized co-ops. And we'll tell you that. But as I said, we've been doing studies on the various states. In some of these areas, the wind just blows like crazy all the time. And so those are areas where obviously we'll be targeting. But literally, there's nothing on the market that fills this gap that I'm filling with the wing generator. And once people see these things working, they're going to go, yeah, we want one of those too. And especially with the inevitable rise of electric pricing. There's, 5 years ago, this was not the case. I was working on the wing generator 5 years ago, and, the conditions, the central power companies ruled Their Majesty the King, the Electric Power Company. And in fact, I remember when I was a kid in Minnesota, the Ready Kilowatt was the power company, the symbol for Northern States Power Company. And Ready Kilowatt had a little crown on his head. He was like King of Electric, you know. But those days are gone. The electric power companies are financially crippled because of their investment in nuclear power. They don't have the money to decommission them. They don't have the money to upgrade them to continue running them. And they're headed for a financial disaster. The big companies are trying to reposition themselves, and they're moving their debt structure. This is one of the things that if your local power company says, well, we're just planning for future debt, and they're installing a bunch of three-blade wind turbines, what they're doing is offsetting that investment in three-blade wind turbines that they know are not going to work to, like, debt. like auxiliary debt or something on the accounting balance sheet. So I'm sure when the bankruptcy courts get a hold of that, they're going to have a pretty evil eye looking at that kind of maneuvering of finances and lying to the public. But the end result is you, the public, are about to be gouged royally for electricity. And so the stage is set for the wing generator to come in and start actually being placed and solving the issues. So right now the stage we're at is with the what I call the small, the 2 kilowatt to the 250 kilowatt systems that will be for farm and ranch and small communities or small, this is another opportunity, small manufacturing facilities. And so if you have a small manufacturing facility that has high electric bills, which there are many, that's another place where we can install wing generators and save you a lot of money on your electric bill. Okay, so just a little bit more about batteries, because the belief in the wind industry, I just saw another study by a Harvard MIT professor, and they were calculating the amount of cost given the cost of batteries and given the electrical energy production of solar and three-blade wind turbines, how much battery capacity would be needed worldwide to go 100% off-grid or to go 100% renewable. And, of course, the numbers are so incredibly fantastic. The dollar amounts, based on current battery technology and current costs of battery technology, that it could never happen in a million years. And so, and that's the point. It was never meant to be a solution. Now, you can't imagine that the GE and the Siemens engineers didn't know that 15 years ago, did they? Of course they knew that. You'd have to be a complete idiot not to know that. That's the first thing an engineer would figure out. So, of course they knew they were selling a bogus product. And that was to protect their core business, which was the Central Power Company, General Electric and Siemens. Go to their webpage, to their electric division, and look at their electric profile. Their equipment goes into major Central Power Company installations. Their sale of generators and their maintenance of generators, that's what their core business is. And wind generation is a pimple over on the side of the butt of GE and Siemens. It's not their core business. It's what they do to make it look like they're trying to do something to save the world. Not the case at all. But so the calculations that have been done for batteries and battery requirements are based on current production or projected production of energy from three-blade wind turbines and solar panels. And, of course, the amount of money involved here is beyond astronomical. The issue with the wing generator is I'm hoping to get it to the point where there is literally no battery requirement at all. And you're going, well, how could you possibly do that? Well, the end result is in systems that I've already have designed and have already operated, in which the excess energy, I'm not going to go into details here, but I don't want to give my competition any ideas, but that solution is on the table. So the idea is to not use batteries at all. But the place you're going to have batteries is in your house. You're going to have an electric car. You're going to have an electric pickup truck. Tesla is coming out with an electric pickup truck in November. They postponed it a little bit. There are various other pickup trucks on the market, electric pickup trucks, and these are amazing. Every redneck that I know, the good old rednecks, the southern boys down there that drive pickup trucks, they're going to be buying these. And so you're going to have batteries in your house. You're probably going to have some kind of battery storage backup also in your house. And I've talked about this also, that my favorite battery is the gel battery. because lithium ion, maybe they're going to cure the problems someday, but I don't see that happening in the near future because of the manufacturing processes and the energy density. There's a goal to get energy density in a battery up to very high levels, but once you do, if that baby goes south and you have some little cell in there, especially with a especially lithium ion, where you have cells that contain the energy, and one of those breaks down, okay, that breaks down, it heats up the localized area, that breaks down the cells around it, that heat breaks down, it's like a nuclear cascade, like a nuclear reaction. Once that baby starts to go internally, forget it. Whereas the gel and the sulfur liquid batteries, etc., don't have that issue because you just can't drain them that fast. Lithium ion, you can drain very quickly. The issue is getting it out the two terminals, but internally, if that starts to break down, that whole battery is going to unload internally, and that's where the meltdown occurs, the explosions, etc. So, you know, there's a benefit to having high energy density, but then there are some failure points that go along with that. So I stick with gel batteries, and of course your automobile probably is going to have lithium ion. But my point is, you're already going to have batteries in your house. And so the idea of a central power company or a major distribution point in an electrical network having batteries is ridiculous. So the whole point here is that with the wing generator system, I am going to work, and I've already got systems that have run without any batteries at all. And you might have a reference battery. You might have a small set of batteries. They might be high voltage that would provide a reference voltage for the equipment to work with. Okay, that's one issue. But as a main source of power when your energy source is failing, that's not a good idea. It's not a good plan to have batteries all over the place, because batteries have a lifetime, they have a cycle time, and unless some absolute miracle happens, the cost is not going to come down to the point where they're going to be economically viable. But what if you could do this? What if you could eliminate the need for batteries, use current technologies, and that's what I've done. And like I say, I'm not going to talk about it on the air, because certainly my competition would try and steal the idea and progress with it. But like I said, I've already run systems like this, and they're very viable. So that's the future. No batteries in the distribution network, in the distribution electric network. Okay, so I led into that topic actually with last week's discussion of sizing batteries and for home systems, etc. A home system, if you have a wing generator for just a home system, then we'll probably stick with a battery pack, but there's other options there. And so you have a minimal battery pack dependency and a minimal cost in batteries. So that's what we're working towards, an alternative energy system that does not rely on batteries. So, and I'll tell you this, the solution I'm talking about is much less expensive than batteries. So that's the future. So with all of the let me just say this, the reason they need batteries is because the standard alternative energy methods don't work. If they worked, you wouldn't need batteries. They would let's just put it this way. Look at the world standards that governments are setting. Let's take an example of a European country that wants to be 30% renewable independent by the year 2030. Okay, well that's interesting. But then they still need the main power source because on that day when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine, they don't have any energy. So, and that's because the alternative energy systems can never reach 100%. And to do 100%, you can't stop at 100%. You need more than 100%. You need much more than 100%, and they'll never reach that at all. So there again, that's where the distributed energy system of the wing generator comes in. I've been around this. This is all specified in my book. Look at, you can read my book, printed in 2009, where I'm talking about all of this, distributed energy networks. Now people have picked up the word distributed and they're misusing it. They're not really talking about a true distributed network. They're talking about stuff scattered all over the place, and that's the way they're using the term distributed. That's not distributed. Distributed implies planning, not just a few things here and a few things scattered over there and plugging them in and basically a Band-Aid for a system that is failing anyway. Okay, so the main thing you should come away with here is that, number one, if you're interested in small local grid independence, if you have communities or if you're a factory or a manufacturing facility that requires a lot of electricity, then we can cut your electric bills drastically and with a very, very fast payback time. Also, just communities, small communities that want to go become as independent as possible from the grid, go to my webpage and email. And also, don't forget that if you want to know what's in your water, like they say, what's in your wallet? Well, what's in your water? Email me with your zip code, and I'll get back to you with some studies that show what's really in your water. And then we can talk water filters also. So I hope this evening's show was informative. Remember, coming to you commercial-free and donation-free and sponsor-free. And just remember, if you don't need water filters, tell your friends, tell your neighbors. And don't forget the paid cast. A lot of good information there for an extremely, extremely low price. And you can also buy my ebook sets along with getting the paid cast at ridiculously low prices also. Once again, thank you. Thank my audience for their attentive response to my request for water filter orders, and I hope that continues in the future. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.